February is Black History Month, and my new book, Immortal Valor, about the Black Medal of Honor recipients of World War II, is out now. The book chronicles these immortal heroes' life journeys through all the pain and struggle up until their ultimate triumphs. I hope you check out the book to discover more as we celebrate Black History Month. Just visit my website at robchild.net or visit any online retailer.
Welcome to Canada in the Great War, our two-part podcast series that brings to life the rise of innovative General Sir Arthur Currie and the Canadian Corps' spearhead in the last 100 days of World War I. I'm Robert Child, and I hope you enjoy the program.
Canada in the Great War, written by Robert Child, narrated by Colin MacLean. July the 1st, 1918, Tank, France. Rising mirage-like in the July haze from the battle-scarred Western Front, a simple playing field and grandstands stood as an oasis of sanity and symbolism. A nation, before the war deemed not deserving of the title Allied Power, boldly invited the world to its Dominion Day party, and they came. The Prince of Wales, the Duke of Connaught, American Commander-in-Chief General John Pershing, British Commander Douglas Haig, and Allied Supreme Commander Ferdinand Foch. They all came to commend, to honour a nation, a corps, and a man whose invitation they would not refuse, General Sir Arthur Currie. Canon Scott, senior chaplain of the Canadian 1st Division, remembers. There must have been nearly 40,000 spectators present. A British general told me that the playing of O Canada by the massed bands was something which made a lump come to one's throat. Canon Scott. Dominion Day 1918 was as much a tribute to recent Canadian military triumphs as it was the de facto passing of the baton and the burden of spearheading the final Allied offensives on the Western Front. It was not what they had done, but what they were expected to do, which made the Canadians and this July celebration so remarkable. German forces just 4 months earlier in March 1918 had overwhelmed the British on the Canadians' left and poured south. And on the Canadians' right, they had overwhelmed the French and had poured west. General Sir Arthur Currie, commander of the Canadian Corps, instinctively knew why the Canadian position had been left untouched. "We've beaten them every time we've fought them. Why would they attack us?" General Arthur Currie. As boastful as General Currie's declaration sounded, it was in fact true. A succession of Canadian military triumphs had led to this extraordinary day honouring the accomplishment of not an army, but a corps comprised of just four divisions. Arthur Currie, the man at the centre of this celebration, was as unlikely a candidate for war hero as ever set foot on a parade ground. Physically unfit and a failure in business before the war, citizen soldier Currie, after having commanded no more than 400 men during peacetime, had risen from relative military obscurity to command of the elite fighting machine on the Western Front, the Canadian Corps. His ascension through an unparalleled string of military successes was a feat most professional soldiers in the British Army would not equal. He often stated, "Everything he learned of war was from fighting the present one," and ironically, inexperience became the foundation of his success. Original thought and stubbornness both endeared and infuriated his superiors, but they came to believe, based on his strategic triumphs, that he had a gift that Napoleon had long ago recognized as vital in a good soldier, coup d'œil, battlefield, intuition. He could read the ground to his own tactical advantage. 19th century military historian Karl von Clausewitz further defined a commander's coup d'œil as having two distinct qualities which are indispensable. First, an intellect that even in the darkest hours retains some glimmering of inner light which leads to truth, and second, the courage to follow this faint light wherever it may lead. Germany's first push through Flanders, Belgium in 1914 brought Britain into the war and in turn, as a member of the Empire, Canada. Germany's plan was a dagger strike at the heart of France, Paris. The First Battle of the Marne in mid-September 1914 halted the German advance and the war of movement on the Western Front. For the next 4 years, protracted trench warfare ensued as German forces captured all the strongest defensive positions in France along a 400-mile front from the North Sea to Switzerland. Behind this formidable barrier, they awaited the Allies to advance and seek their own destruction. By 1918, millions of men had been thrown against this impenetrable concrete wall, and it had not budged but a few miles in either direction. Salisbury Plain. As if foreshadowing the war's epic struggle and untold hardships ahead, Canadian forces began life on Britain's vast, mythical and rain-swept Salisbury Plain, and Lance Corporal Charles Henry Savage was among them. I suppose that there were intermediate weather conditions, but in retrospect two extremes always present themselves to me. Either it was raining and streams of water were flowing everywhere, or it was bright and dry and the wind was blowing the sand into our eyes and clothes, but more particularly into our food. I gained 10 pounds in weight while at Salisbury, and I'm sure it must all have been in sand. Charlie Savage. Canadian forces embarking from Salisbury Plain for the front in the spring of 1915 believed nothing could be worse than what they had just endured. They could not have been more wrong. Today the bucolic beauty of Flanders Fields in western Belgium and the walled city of Ypres stand in stark contrast to its violent past. Raided by the Romans in the 1st century BC during the First World War, this ancient city stood squarely in the path of the German war machine. Today, remembrance is kept very much alive in Ypres at the British Menin Gate Memorial. Each night of the year, without exception, as has been the tradition for over 8 decades, the Ypres Fire Brigade buglers perform the Last Post in tribute to the missing and fallen soldiers of the Great War. The apprenticeship of Arthur Currie began here at the notorious Ypres salient, where, as a brigade commander, he gained first-hand experience of the inherent chaos and uncertainty of war. 1915 marked the dawn of the deadliest and most psychologically devastating weapon unleashed on the Western Front. 90 years later, the air in Langemark remains unmistakably oppressive. This was a place of unspeakable terror and instant death. Codenamed Disinfection, the first German gas attack on April the 22nd left 6,000 French and Algerian troops dead, drowned in the fluid of their own collapsed lungs. Fleeing forces left a 4-mile gaping hole in the lines, which the Canadian 1st Division on their right scrambled to refill. General Currie, commanding the 2nd Brigade, with communication lines cut, took the initiative to seek reinforcements. As soon as I arrived and mentioned to General Snow that apparently there was a gap between the left of my 8th Battalion and the 3rd Brigade troops, he shouted at me and asked, "How dare I allow such a gap to occur?" To hear him, you would think that I personally and solely was responsible for that gap. He roundly abused me and told me to get out, shouting at me, "Give them hell, give them hell!" Arthur Currie. The next day, hell descended on the Canadians. Remembered as the Battle of St. Julian, the Germans, unable to exploit their earlier breakthrough, squarely targeted the Canadian-held apex near Gravenstafel Ridge. It was an all-out effort to obliterate the salient. At 4:10 a.m. on the 24th, the gas returned. To their shock, half-blind, choking men, desperately firing jamming Ross rifles but refusing to surrender, met the advancing German 4th Army. The 1st Canadian Division, against seemingly hopeless odds, held the salient, but at terrible cost. More than 6,000 men, fully one-third of Canada's entire fighting force, were casualties. The German decision to gas the Canadians at St. Julian instilled in them a deep hatred of the enemy. General Currie, in comments after the war, stated, "We gassed them in return every chance we got." The Canadian stand at St. Julian had robbed gas of its psychological impact, and Currie's performance, despite General Snow's condemnation, was commended. He was promoted to Major General and commander of the 1st Canadian Division, and Curry wasted little time in formulating schemes to disrupt the enemy. Winter 1915 marked General Curry's initiation of dangerous but effective night raids designed to capture prisoners and demoralize the enemy. He told his men, "We own the ground right up to the lip of their trenches." On June 2, 1916, at Mount Sorrel, the most massive bombardment yet of Canadian troops began. There was no warning, no gradual working up to a crescendo of fire. One moment it was a beautiful, quiet June morning, the next it was a hell of exploding shells. The shock of the sudden noise alone was almost overpowering. In unexpectedness and intensity, it was comparable to an explosion in a powder plant. Charlie Savage. Newly installed commander of the Canadian Corps and architect of the recent brilliant Allied withdrawal from Gallipoli, General Julian Byng ordered Arthur Currie to lead an immediate counterattack. Currie protested for more time to properly plan, as no one knew where the Germans were. Byng refused and set the attack for 2 a.m. June the 3rd. As Currie feared, the attack failed. Byng now gave Currie the time he had originally requested to develop a plan of his own. Currie began here what would become his hallmark use of artillery in an innovative way. Rather than the predictable approach of sending the ground attack over the top immediately after the artillery barrage, the Canadians began and ceased the artillery four times. At the end of each barrage, the Germans would man their guns and prepare for the attack that did not come. By the time the Canadians actually attacked at 1:30 a.m., the German defenders had lost their edge and were thrown off their normal routines. 1 hour was all it took for the men to regain all the ground lost to the Germans in the attack on June the 2nd. General Currie had successfully executed his first deliberately planned attack on the Western Front. It would not be his last. The Somme. Somme. The whole history of the world cannot contain a more ghastly word. Friedrich Steinbrecher, German infantryman. Echoes of one of the bloodiest slaughters in recorded history have not died away from the hallowed river valley in north-central France called the Somme. The flower of a generation marched to its doom in a capture of less than 5 miles of bloody ground. Launched to draw German forces away from Verdun, the losses during the Battle of the Somme exceeded even those at Verdun. The first day of the battle, July 1, 1916, remains the bloodiest day in the history of the British Army. 57,470 casualties. Canadian forces joined the ill-conceived Somme operation in mid-September, after the battle had slowed to a stalemate. Currie, in his first meeting at headquarters, and the junior man present, suggested a solution to break the deadlock. Attack at noon instead of dawn. Still, in the bog that was the Somme battlefield, platoon after muddy platoon of Canadian soldiers, including Charlie Savage, prepared themselves to go over the top. The time was interminable, and the suspense nerve-wracking. There was nothing to do but think. Did the Germans expect an attack? Had the artillery been successful in cutting the wire in front of us? When would my next leave come? 2 minutes to go. It was impossible to hear anyone speak. The air was full of dust, dirt, and smoke. 10 seconds to go. Thank God we'll soon be out of this. How many of the platoon is left? Have I a cartridge in the chamber? Is the safety catch off? Time! Over we go. Currie would carry many lessons with him as a result of his inexperience at the Somme. In early January 1917, as the lone Canadian officer, he joined senior British officers at Verdun for a battlefield study. After the visit, Currie wrote a tactical analysis of the Verdun battles, which would become future doctrine for the Canadian Corps. He rejected outright the British tactic of attacking in waves. Accordingly, he recognised the emphasis that the French put on platoon and company-level tactics. He focused on the primacy of artillery and believed that the infantry required intimate artillery support onto their objective as well as counter-battery fire. Little did Arthur Currie know that his formulation of the fire and manoeuvre doctrine would be the basis for his next great battle. Vimy Ridge, France. Vimy Ridge, a battle which would come to define Canada's nationhood, would earn for Arthur Currie a knighthood. Impregnable Vimy Ridge, he determined, was actually a complex series of German strong points that could be targeted. He again used night raids to gather intelligence and tunneled deep into the ridge to hide troops moving in and out of the front lines. In a field behind the ridge, he began with Julian Byng to rehearse the battle on a replicated model of the battle zone, while 2 weeks of accurate bombardment softened the enemy position. Currie's motto, learned at Verdun, was, "Neglect nothing." Just 2 days after America declared war on Germany, Zero Hour arrived, and on April 9, 1917, 4 divisions of well-rehearsed Canadian troops, moving in platoon formation, charged headlong toward the German stronghold atop Vimy Ridge. By nightfall of the opening day, most of the ridge was in Canadian hands. In a single day, Canadians had advanced farther than any other British offensive had up until that time. That day, more ground, more prisoners, and more guns were taken than in the entire 2.5 years of the war. Army Commander Sir Henry Horne sent Currie a message calling his division the pride and wonder of the British Army. On June 8, 1917, Arthur Currie was promoted to command of the entire Canadian Corps. At 41 years of age, he was the youngest Lieutenant General and the first non-regular officer to reach such high command. Currie then moved to his new headquarters at Camblin-l'Abbé, where he planned and won another decisive victory at Hill 70 in August. Ordered by General Haig to attack the city of Lens, Currie instead chose to attack and occupy strategically important Hill 70 close to Lens. He reasoned that the Germans would be forced to advance and seek their own destruction. Currie, after 3 years of brutality, had learned well from his worthy adversary. Passchendaele. Douglas Haig's Third Battle of Ypres, known universally as Passchendaele, had begun July 31, 1917. In 3 months of intense fighting, nearly 500,000 British soldiers lay dead or wounded in a vast former marshland which, with August rains, had become a quagmire. General Currie did not see any reason or significance in sending his men forward to this slaughter. Why? What good of it? Passchendaele, a name for a lot of mud and grief. What's the good of it? Let the Germans have it, keep it, rot in the mud. There's a mistake somewhere. It must be a mistake. It isn't worth a drop of blood. Arthur Currie. General Currie's vehement protests were ignored, so he made certain he had the artillery support needed to cover his troops, even going so far as to count the guns himself. He knew, even despite his careful preparation, that many of his men would perish in the Passchendaele mud. General Currie estimated a loss of an appalling 16,000 Canadian troops. Agonized by this certainty, he stood for 3 hours in the cold and saluted his men as they passed to the front. Tragically, Currie's estimate was accurate almost to a man. 15,654 Canadian men, indeed, did not return. Canadian forces, however, as at Vimy following Currie's plan, had again prevailed. Due to their staggering losses, the British were seriously short of manpower by the close of 1917. Their solution was to reduce the size of their divisions from 12 to 9 battalions, and they wanted the Canadians to follow suit. For the Canadians, this course of action would involve dividing the existing corps in favour of an army of 2 smaller corps. Currie was dead set against the proposed changes. He felt that such a move would degrade the corps' combat efficiency, which, in its current form, had become second to none. Currie offered up an alternative. Instead of increasing the staff, he suggested increasing the establishment of each battalion by 100 men, thus increasing each division's strength by 1,200 men. Currie's solution, coming as it did at the expense of a promotion and army command for himself, is perhaps the quintessential example of selfless professionalism. Indeed, Andy McNaughton, counter-battery staff officer of the Canadian Corps, wrote that Curry was one of very few men who could have made a decision entirely on the basis of the efficiency of Canada's contribution to the war. And as late summer of 1918 approached, with the world's eyes upon them, the Canadians' contribution to the war was about to set new benchmarks in modern military history.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thanks for listening. I'm Robert Child. Be with us next week for the conclusion of Canada in the Great War. I'll see you next time.
Music licensed from audioblocks.com. Point of the Spear is produced by RSC Media Group.